Memory Man Sandy, please. Sunday night, but that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack the Sun. Welcome you to 235th episode of the John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 234 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. www.johnmack13.com. Next week is the Memorial Day weekend, and as such, there'll be no radio show. Nor will there be for the next 2 weeks thereafter as I date ship around the beautiful Hudson Valley. I'll return at June 16th, refreshed and ready to go for another year. Down to this week's show, as I mentioned, the 235th in the series. This is a very unusual show, as while I have had two guests at a time at an earlier show, in this case, there may be up to 12 on one show. It'll be interesting to see if I can control it. If I can, I guess I'll be ready to host panels on CNN or on MSNBC. The listeners wishing to join us on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I will hold a call of participation until the end of my conversation with the multiple guests. This show really had its genesis on February 21st of this year, when I was honored to be the fourth featured poet at the Old Putt at the historic Freight House in Mayapack, New York. The Freight House building was constructed in 1872 to service the Mayapack train station for the long-defunct Old Putt Railroad, the branch of the New York Central. The building had such been turned into a wonderful cafe by its owner and our hostess, Donna Massaro. The conclusion to my reading, we then had an open mic session, and a number of local poets read their work. That led to me putting together a recently published anthology, Live at the Freight House, which in turn led to a return to the Freight House the night before last for another go-around to the poets' book signing and sales, and the treat is Ralph Nazareth, coordinator of the legendary Tuesdays at Curly's in Stamford, Connecticut, served as our featured poet. Ralph and other poets, mystery guests from around the East Coast, will join us tonight as we try to recapture not only that night, but other poetry readings. I will start off with the first poem that I read on Friday night, as a matter of fact, the first poem that I ever read, and then get out of the way and serve as an MC. The poets do not know when I'll be calling on them, and have agreed to just be ready. I will ask each to tell us how they came to poetry, what are their featured publications, and how, and then to read a poem. At the conclusion of the run through, they'll open the floor to general conversation. Okay, here we go. I'm up. Cashing a check. I just saw this wonderful line in a column in a motorcycle magazine. The mind writes checks that the body can't cash. The vision that many of us from the old neighborhood have of me is short and thin with a Pepsi in one hand and a cigarette in the other. Others will remember me as taller and thin, hitting the jumper from the corner or throwing the no-look pass to a cutter. Others will picture me at the end of the bar in a Broadstone with an open pack of Pall Malls and a half-finished beer in a bar. Don Gibson, I can't stop loving you, and the jukebox. Pat, one more and you have a chance. Age has taken the jumper. Diabetes has taken the Pepsi. Common sense has taken the cigarettes and the booze. But to once more be able to fake the man guarding me and go up with the jumper and get nothing but net, to be able once more to cash that check. When reading the New York Times today, I was struck by how the page one headline reminded me of the poem that that Terry Dugan read the other night after that she had written after the Parkland shooting. It's in the book, and I'm asking to read it again now. Terry, please read the same poem after telling us how you came to poetry.
Okay, I'll read the poem first, and then I'll tell you how it all happened. The New Curriculum, February 15, 2018, the day after Parkland, Florida shooting. Today's pop math quiz. How many screaming students fit into a classroom closet when the shooting starts? Today's chemistry lab work. What chemical cleans the blood in hallways, on computers, lockers, and desks? Today's phys ed drill. How fast can you run when you see a gun? How quick can you drop and roll? Today's government and civics quiz. If 90% of Americans shout gun control, what percent of Congress will shut them down? Today's health education test. How do you perform CPR on a kid bleeding from an AR-15 automatic? Today's history question. How soon will we forget your dead classmates and teachers? Remember the thoughts and prayers from political leeches. So as you can see, I was kind of angry and reacting very much. And I think that's one of the things that I like about poetry, is that unlike fiction and nonfiction, which takes a while to polish and fix and stuff, you can really go quickly and distill the emotions that you feel and the observations that you make when you're responding to something like this Parkland shooting, and again, just 2 days ago, the Santa Fe, Texas shooting. I have to say, I wrote poetry in college, like so many people, and then I put it behind me. You know, although I used to love to go to poetry readings, and when I was getting my MFA a few years ago, I suddenly realized that poetry was something I should have pursued, and I was forced to take a poetry class and fell in love with it all over again. So since then, I've published in quite a few journals, and I've been invited to read my poetry at the United Nations and museums and colleges in this area. So I've been a little bit surprised at, a good reception. But, you know, this is poetry. It rewards you in many, many ways.
Well, thank you very much, Terry. Terry, like most of the of tonight's guests have been previous guests on the show, and are members of any combination of the Mayor Pack Writers Group, the Mayor Pack Poetry Workshop, and the Yorktown Poetry Workshop. The Mayor Pack Poetry Workshop, coordinated by poet M. Grau, introduced me to our next poet, John Capriellin, who, to get himself back into poetry, wrote a poem every day for a year and have since published the result. John, you're up.
Okay. Well, I got into poetry. Really, I had a fabulous high school teacher, Roy Frensky, who really introduced me to poetry and read quite a bit of it back then, was very much influenced by Yevgeny Yevtushenko, E. Cummings, Wallace Stevens, William Carlos Williams. And I started to write and continued when I got into college, and I took some poetry classes at Cornell. And, you know, after I got out of college, I pretty much slowly stopped writing and didn't write for quite a long time. Every once in a while, something would come to me, and I would give it a try. But I had been just unmotivated, and I heard a story on NPR at one point about someone who was writing a poem a day, and I think he was either tweeting them or posting them to Facebook. And I thought, I wonder if I could do that. I kind of nixed the posting them to Facebook idea because I figured, I don't know if I wanted to be that public right away. But I did put them on a blog that's, Lord knows, you know, if anyone was reading them. But I managed to pull it off. 366 poems because it was a leap year. And once I did that, I decided, wow, you know, I don't have something. I should do something with it. So I published the book, and to great reviews by, you know, four people. But I really did. It really started me back on the road to writing regularly. And being part of the workshop has been great. And I'm trying to do more submissions and trying to get into more journals. I did get into the 5-2, which is a crime poetry online journal. And that has sort of motivated me to make more submissions. I was trying to decide what to read this evening, and I figured, well, you know, it's John's show, so I should read something political, because he's never shies away from that, so I thought I'd give it a try. This is something I wrote very recently. It's called Platform. Here's what they want, I think. A gun and the Bible in every home in order to do unto others. No contraception, no abortion, no sex education, no welfare, no food stamps. Just hordes of starving babies. For target practice, I guess. A land washed white, cleansed of regulation, where money flows freely and toxins pour into our water and air. A nation walled to keep out the naturally rising sea, and the rising tide of immigrants here to take our jobs, rob our homes, and rape our women. I fear a new civil war is coming, and the wrong side has all the guns.
Thank you very much, John.
You're welcome.
The only contributor who's to the book who's with us tonight was not with us on Friday night. Vincent Bell had some other minor conflict, something about the daughter getting married. But he is here.
I'm here.
He is here now. Vincent?
Yes, sir.
You're up.
Good evening. A little bit of background. I started writing poetry when I was in high school, which was a real long time ago. And didn't get much of a response. And just like the previous poet who just spoke, I stopped writing for a very long time. In my case, it was really decades, with occasional explosions of words in my head, which caused me to write them down. And I always said to myself that when I finally got to the point where I didn't need to work anymore, I was going to write full time, and I started doing that, I guess, about 3 years ago. And I've written a ton of poems. I was thrilled to get to have three of my poems published in the anthology that John was talking about, and I have five poems coming out in an online journal in June called Off Course. And I wanted to read a poem that I wrote called Drinking Alone. Drinking alone, I walked into a bar and saw Walt Whitman sitting there staring into his drink. He looked tired and past his prime. His once impressive beard now showed mottled gaps of skin. He started one of those bar conversations about sports and TV. After a few sentences, he said that he had been a poet, but he hadn't written anything recently. I said I was a poet who was still writing, and he said that he felt sorry for me. Walt said it was different when he was younger. He had freed American poets from their own vestigial limits. Other than editors, poets don't have any natural predators. Their words flood the blank pages. And, you know, it's a blessed time for me because I just get to write all the time now, and I'm really having a blast, and I'm very grateful to John for giving me a platform in order to reach people. Thank you.
And thank you, Vincent. I mentioned earlier that a feature poet on Friday night was Ralph Nazareth. I've asked Ralph to read two poems. I'd like him to do one now and one at the end as we start to wrap it up. So Ralph, you're on now, and thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, John, and had a wonderful time on Friday. What an attentive and engaged group you have there. Beautiful. All right. This is a poem called Orientation for New Immigrants. So you want to fit in? Okay, then. The first step you must take is to learn to say fuck without blushing. Say fuck, and once more, fuck. And not wilt every time you hear it, which would be every other step as your American counterparts take it out on whatever's in their path. The fucking door, the fucking tree, the fucking bush. No, not the president, of course, God bless America, but the bush that just sits there and doesn't do anyone any harm, doesn't declare dead or alive, or bring him on, trapped on decks of warships and borrowed fighter pilots' gear, doesn't proclaim mission accomplished. In the bud, like a premature ejaculation, doesn't chant ad nauseam, we will prevail, and all options are on the table. You are with us or against us. God is on our side. It's just an innocuous, unremarkable, ordinary, plain as fucking plain can be bush. If you wish to go deeper into this culture, to climb the Trump Tower faster, be top dog, you may not want to stop with fuck. Go further, the whole hog and enchilada, as they say, the whole fucking nine yards, and practice saying fuck, piss, shit as often as you hear them. Practice makes fucking perfect.
Thank you very much, Ralph. Ralph came to get his postgraduate degree 50 years ago and stayed.
Yes.
And he's been writing and teaching, and he's presently teaching it in the maximum security prison at Sing Sing. And it's and he said Friday night that that's a very moving experience for him.
Yes.
Once again, thanks for being
here.
Thanks
for the opportunity. Thank you.
One of my regular guests on this show, who's on most weeks with commentary on what he's heard, is Chick Donahue, whose book on his rather bizarre delivery of beer to a civilian to friends of Vietnam is available on Amazon. Chick's younger brother, Bob, is an author and poet living in New Hampshire, the previous guest on this show, and joins us now. Do you have the poem for us, Bob?
Yeah, I do, and thanks for inviting me, John. Just very briefly, I came to poetry actually in the sixth grade, Good Shepherd School in Inwood, and there was a poetry contest, and I made my contribution, and I didn't win. Penny Sheehan won, you know, remember Penny Sheehan, but
certainly.
I remember reading that poem to my godmother, and it moved her. It moved her to tears. And I recognized the power in the words, although I couldn't have articulated it at the time. You know, any tool you could use at that time was the graph. So I've been writing poetry ever since. And for many years, I wrote virtually daily. And I ended up at the Sarah Lawrence Writing Extension Center with a group of poets, and then went to the Omega Institute in Rhinebeck. Met a group of people, poets, and we hung together for the next 4 years. That was in around the year 2000. And we would go off at the beginning of winter and at the beginning of spring to Block Island and spend some time there. So what I'm going to read now is from my only published work, which came out of an anthology of poems that came off of Block Island from that group. And it's called From Here On. For now, I will ignore storms that lie offshore, trust that they will blow to their ends, and fate will handle my part safely. I choose estuarial. Trace a trickled quiet flow past soft-topped reeds up mud-caked streams, over decayed carcasses of incidents, slights, and pungent betrayals, foolish acts of old despair. I dip my hands in the ooze about me, knuckles scraped, fingers seared to a freeze. I turn stones, lift cracked shells, search for what seems odd or new, missed meanings, perhaps. I allow heart rips and sharp pulls, the always residue of shame and poor choices. Then I move up toward source, take what comes to clear my clinging fears, engage manageable threats, and hold fast all the delicate parts that seem true. On this Chesapeake-like afternoon at winter's cusp, I embrace coldness as good company and set off once more toward beginnings.
Wow. Thank you very much, Bob. We'll be back to you in a bit. Those of you that have the book will see that there's one person who chose not to be identified by his name. He only has LC as the as his designation. He wanted to be anonymous. Well, tonight he will tell you exactly who he is, and he'll tell us how he got into poetry, and then to read his poem to you. Delaney, you're up.
Okay. Hello, all. I got into writing short stories, and somehow I, through an event, I met Dan Masterson, who is a poet laureate of Rockland, and he convinced me to join him and to start writing some poetry. Now, tonight, I'm not going to read the one I wrote, but I wrote a new one for tonight. I was thinking about something when I was a kid, and it goes like this. One sizzling summer afternoon, I pedaled my bike, baseball cards clicking on spokes, click, 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 coontails on hand grips in rear fender, standing erect in the wind as I made my way, soon to come to stay, giving way. A sprightly girl flaunted her early essence of in my path, no more than 13 or 14. She wore a pink halter clinging to her nubbin breasts, matching pink shorts, bearing her tight tummy of no more than 20 round. The rhythm of her fanny beamed like a semaphore, leaving little to vision. Filled with determination and smile, ponytails swayed to the beat of her stride, her presence a slap of wind in my face. Eyes affixed to the magic she oozed, her image jolted my brain, rousted my blood, other forces as well. The hook was thrown into male waters. A new sense emerged in my 12-year-old brain. When beckoned, she looked, she gleamed. Female mysteries arose, a quiz for me, but I was hooked. And that's my first recollection of the other side as a partner.
And are you going to tell the assemblage what your whole name is, Lenny?
Oh, yeah, Lenny Sarigliano. Like I said, I like to write short stories. It's something that's pretty new to me, and so is poetry, very new to me. And I figured I'd just try it out, and I get a nice, comfortable feeling when I try to write. And
thank you very much for now. Now, Ralph, do you have that second poem ready?
Me, you. Before I sign off, thank you one more time. This is a wonderful program. Here it is. It's a bit of prose.
Ralph.
Ready?
Ralph, I'm not hearing you. Yes. Yeah, go ahead, please.
I'd hoped that my book would stop the world in its tracks. I made sure copies were sent to family members and close friends, who, in turn, would, I hoped, disseminate my poems far and wide. My sister, a Port Claire Franciscan cloistered nun, who had led a life of silence, prayer, and penance for over 50 years, was the first to respond. "A lot of words, dear brother," she wrote. "I, for one, wish to enter the silence of God." It was a bitter pill, but what did I expect? My oldest brother, fingering my slim volume, said to me, "So, you got yourself published. Good for you. My only hope is to have my name inscribed in the Book of Heaven." Still clinging to a sliver of hope and affirmation, I turned to my other brother, my literary inspiration, the one who used to declaim lines from Shakespeare and the great poets when I was little and stir me to my very depths. He hesitated a bit, then smiling, he said, "Look here, have no fear. There's no chance anyone will want to pirate this." No one who was crushed could have laughed as hard as I did. I rushed to the sea with my box of books. I flung some into the waves, hoping they'd float and carry away my secrets. They sank to the bottom. Some were snatched out of my hands by raucous gulls. A few scuttled away as crabs and ducked into their dank caverns. I tore up the rest and gave them to the wind. My words blew away and became part of, as they say, the great unknown. No, make it just the unknown.
that you read that the other night, and I thought that was hilarious. And we've all had things like that, of course. Before you go anyplace, you've been teaching poetry for years and years. Do you have any comments for the people that have just recently gotten into poetry?
Yes, it's such a an extraordinary way of being human. That is, being in words is, I feel this, maybe I'm biased, but it is the deepest way of being human. That is, paying attention to experience and to the things of the world. And poems wash up on our shores every day in so many different forms. I mean, big poems, little poems, loud ones, very silent ones, rhythmic ones, ones that are not so agile, some that are utterly musical, some that catch the music of the street, so to say. My own dream is that I be blessed or graced with poems that can be read and heard in the marketplace. That is my dream. A poem should be accessible without compromising the depths.
Thank you very much for stopping by, Ralph. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay. I have other people trying to get in because there's a whole bunch of people. They should be joining us in just a few minutes. Let me come back to Terry to see if Terry's still with us. No, I don't see Terry still with us. I know that she had to get off. Where is she here? 3991. Who's 3991? Vincent. John, while other people get in, do you have anything else that to read to us?
Sure. I've got this one. We had a little discussion in our last poetry group about Frost, so I had a poem that I thought I could read. It's called Intersections. It's not the road you take that makes all the difference, Mr. Frost. Each road has its own set of circuitous switchbacks, ruts and potholes leading to some enigmatic final destination. We choose them not knowing where they lead, despite signs, directions, warnings. Sometimes we double back and make another choice, or blaze a path between two. But no, that doesn't make all the difference, for the path is ultimately unimportant. What matters are our fellow travelers met at the intersections. Some join us merely until the next crossing, others for the entire journey or until they reach their goal. Our plans change when we travel together, and perhaps we'll take a middle road or detour on an adventure or just relish the company. Every person we meet changes our journey, sometimes tripping us up, other times carrying us when we are far too weary to continue or too scared to find what hides around the next bend. I have been lucky, rarely having to travel alone.
I like that. And it's very different from what you read before. So,
mm-hmm.
I like that. I like that very much. I mentioned earlier that that Bob Donahue's older brother, Chick, is one of my oldest friends.
Mm-hmm.
Chick, what do you think of all this poetry stuff?
Very interesting, John. I'm learning a lot.
And is anything moving you toward writing poetry?
No, I have gained some interest in it, like somebody else who mentioned earlier. I never paid any attention to poetry. I enjoyed drinking beer up in Harvard Yard with Seamus Haney, but and he was a very interesting gentleman. But otherwise, no, I've read some of his poems, and I've gotten something out of them. I have. But since you've started this poetry on the radio for me, I'm learning.
Well, that's all we can hope for, I guess. I'll be back to you. Vincent, do you have anything else with you that you care to read for us?
The poem I'll read. It's called The Trump Tube. After narrowly avoiding civil war, elections were finally held for a new president. Then Donald Trump was placed in an iron lung for the safety of the nation. The new leaders thought that this was a just punishment because he couldn't play golf or grope women or reach his own penis. The Trump tube would allow him to tweet with assistance, and it would force him to breathe while restricting all else.
Wow. Wow, that's the most political thing we've had yet, even though John talked about my political reading.
Yeah, it's interesting. I usually don't write political poems, but the current environment is causing me to reconsider a lot of things that I didn't used to write about.
The aforementioned Chick Donahue was a political operative for his union. Chick, what do you think of that poem?
Well, I don't like to talk about the person who is the president right now. I'm retired, and I don't know what to say, Johnny. I just don't know what to say. I'm very upset with what's happening to my country, and every day I say a prayer for it, and it's scary, and too many of us are just getting used to it. I'm terrified, but there's little I can do about it from this end.
John, you mentioned political poetry before. Do you have any comments on Vince's poem?
Oh, I love it. I think it's brilliant. I don't write a lot of political poetry either, or at least I did not for a long time. If you looked at my 366 poems, there weren't very many of them there. But sometimes events just thrust it upon you, and you really have to do something. And I've written a lot more political poems since we've had our illustrious orange president. But I thought the poem was great. I very much liked it.
Thank you very much.
Bob, yeah. Donahue, what do you think?
And like the others, I don't write political poems, but I certainly have feelings, as other people have expressed. And a little like my brother, I'm finding that I have more space to do my work, you know, and I write full time. So I have more space to do my work when I'm not agonizing over this guy. And I, you know, I allow myself the smallest amount of time each day to listen to the news. But I find that that's often too much. Like Chick said, I pray. That's what I do. And contribute to people, I think, can contribute money to people, I think, can make a difference or make a change or whatever. I guess it's best to kind of leave it there. You know, I can lose my mind easily over what's going on. So,
John, a completely different topic. Your poem that you read the other night took us back to the original old putt. Do you have that handy?
I can get a second. Oh, actually, let me just grab your book. That's the easiest way to do it. Sure thing. Okay, here we go. After the war, when my dad was a teen, trying to escape the heat and losing his father to cancer, he would take the train, the old putt, up from the Bronx on Fridays, with a bag and a fishing rod, getting off at Mayapack, crossing Route 6, climbing the hill to Mary Avenue, where his uncle lived, in a house he built from the cement he wheeled from the lumberyard across the street and mixed with water from the public well. He'd lie in bed and hear his uncle, his Amogli, drumming on his headboard and singing Armenian songs. In the morning, he would take a rowboat out on the lake and fish around the islands where the bass would lurk. Alone on the water, he could relax. He always loved his time in Mayapack. When we moved there, he never wanted to come and explore the places in his past with me. He stuck to the stories and memories of the loving escape he found there. And on Saturday, and on Sunday, he would grab his bag and his pole, and the train would take him back home to his mother and his sister and the quiet, empty apartment.
And then you wound up moving up here, obviously.
Yep.
Yeah. Vincent, how? Not Vincent. I'm sorry. Lenny, how about the original one that you did read?
Well, I was just going to read another one I just wrote, if you
okay.
don't mind.
Okay, you can do that.
Okay, get my glasses on here. It's called Sleep Must Come, and this is actually a true story. I lay in bed, sleep is a must, my mother said. You must go to sleep for your body to grow, but sleep did not come so easily. I twist and I turned and I strained for sleep to come. Oh, what will I do? I will never grow. There on the wall, a picture, a little boy just as me. In his bed, covered in soft linen white, his head on pillow, eyes gazing at me. Oh, I wish that could be me. In that moment's time, I saw the boy move just as me. Arms stretched. A smile and a blink of eye. With the smile and a little giggle, I remembered the mirror on the wall. With the yawn and heavy lids, I closed my eyes.
No, that's very different than anything you've done before, I think.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm trying. That's, I guess, how you learn.
Bob, how about one more from you?
This Bob? Bob Donahue?
Bob Donahue, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, this is actually a recent poem. It's called As Light Lengthens. Spring comes slow to New Hampshire and feels on arrival like a prize, a small gilded statuette. One after long exertions, like the blend of a friend who spent years abroad, falls into my hungry embrace. Canada chills, sliced southern air, and threatens to make an end of the bomb, this afternoon delivered. Grasses remain beige brown, a rise in temperature loosens ground to the menace of mud. Lichen holes at northern tree trunks, as though its mint green toughness may be all we will ever know of color or natural growth. Like a cruel aunt or a crabby uncle may spoil a child's Saturday joy. This place is granite proud and moves quietly from tough persuasions, but it loves summer too much to ignore the inexorable. So sturdy flower stalks jut from house joints where faint warmth lingers. The sun is teased to stay a little longer each day. Buds make countless solitary blossoms of new life, unlike the clustered burgeoning of their southern cousins. But life they make of myriad tints, fragrances, and exquisite form. Trees gather leaves, flowers petals, to be among such orchestrated epics, and sense the spirit's stir they send all about, wakes me, so used to the lush of warmer places, and lifts a veil of winter's forgetting. That covers the oldest truth. Life loves itself.
It does. We've talked about how that we start writing and then we keep writing and we keep trying to get better. It reminded me of the poem that I didn't read the other night. That is in the book, For Reality. Reading Billy Collins or Bukowski or Sharon Olds is like watching Ty Williams hit, or Steve Jobs sell a concept, or Larry Bird see the thought, or Stephen Hawking think. I've aspired to all these skills and try my best, but... And I think that we all see this. There are so many people have said that there aren't people reading poetry. I know that Joyce Carol Oates had said there's many people write poetry that's read it, and Billy Collins said that she was wrong, that there are more people that write it than read it. But there are so many places to publish poetry now. There are so many different places. They're all both in the annual Poets Market, but even more important, if you belong to Duotrope, that's $5 a month, and that constantly has it's not only it's a place to keep the inventory of your submissions, but it's also constantly telling you of new markets, and they're all over the place. Well, you get to meet someone that's published someplace. Bob Donohue told me about the short story that he published in Down in the Dirt, a magazine I had never heard of. Well, it turns out that it's one of the publications of an umbrella called Scars.tv, and I've since had five things accepted by the two publications of four poems and the short stories. So you hear things like this, and you keep. John mentioned that he'd been published on the 5-2. John, what is the 5-2? That's an interesting title.
Yeah, it's a crime poetry journal, but the definition sort of crime poetry is really the poet's own definition of what makes it somehow crime related.
And what was your crime?
Feature one poem a week. My poem was called Just Us. I can read it if you like.
Please do.
Sure. They sit in cells, alone but for a steel cot to lie with, and slack-jawed toilet frozen in mid-mock. They sit and pray for exoneration before it's too late, for witnesses to recant their lies, for DNA to open eyes of prosecutors blinded by fear and hate. They sit and wonder how they got there, terror, confusion, threats and cries over and over until it was all too much and they said what they wanted to hear just so it would stop. Then the empty hours, time bent and jangled, night and day mixed to concrete gray, solitary cell, solitary hell. They sit and wait for death, or just, perhaps, without warning or apology, the sweet caress of freedom.
Which may never come.
Which may never come, but does on rare occasions. That poem was inspired by hearing the story of a man who was in prison for something like 40 years for a crime he did not commit.
And Vincent, do you have another for us?
Yeah, I do, actually. Unfortunately, it's another political poem. It's called American Gulag. After Christmas, when the hunted become hunters, I see only dead trees and Amazon boxes. In our gulag, I am a poet, not a psychologist or a professor, but simply a victim of nice chapbooks filled with well-behaved poems. We need more dive bar stanzas about how clotty blood slows in our streets.
That's kind of stark. Yes, it is.
Yeah, how I feel about what's going on.
Well, that's important. That's all that we can do is we can bring out to what is important to us. The other night at the gala that we had at the Freight House, Susan Andrews, one of the people in the audience, asked, what is the process for us all and how do we get there? She's a prose writer, and she was trying to understand to what's different. And as we went around the room, it was very different for many of us. We all were writing about things that were important to us at the time. Some, like John, were based on his view or his capturing things around him, phrases that he'd write down or on the train going into to Manhattan. Others like Jim Casey had been thinking about religion and philosophy for 30 years since his years as the Christian Brother, and his poems related to how his whole thought process had changed, and he was trying to make us think. My poems tend to be rather short usually and a little punchy. I'm looking for irony or for a laugh. That they're not meant to be slapstick, but the idea is try to cause people to look at something just different than they had. So but it all seems to come from within. John, do you want to add anything on what I just said?
No, I would agree. It comes from many sources. I mean, a lot of my stuff is observation. It starts that way, but sometimes it's just playing with language. Sometimes it's reactions to current events. Sometimes it's just seeing something, you know, on the street. I wrote a poem because I saw some oyster shells on the street, and it reminded me of the story of how oysters used to be poor people's food, and I wrote a piece on that. And you never know where it's going to come from, the inspiration.
Lenny, you seem to be reaching back somewhat into your childhood. Is that what you're aiming at? And you've also written about army life.
Today I just was doing that, and I got involved in that, and I just tried to write a little bit about early days. I do have the one on the service, and I do have a few other ones that I've written. That's about it. I don't know why I write that way, but I just tried to really sit back and think.
Yeah. This is Vincent. I'd just like to mention one thing, which is, as I said before, I've hardly ever in my life written political stuff, but I think as writers now, we have to work with whatever our tools are, whatever our talents are, to try and make statements about what we see going on that's disturbing us in the political environment. As much as I would prefer to write about other things, I think we have a responsibility to deal with it.
Don't we risk the possibility that people will get tired of us hitting them over the head, and they'll look for a more mixed bag from other poets, Vincent?
It's certainly a huge risk, and I think about it all the time, but, you know, I have to do what comes from inside of me and what my muse tells me to do. I mean, I would love to get to the point where I could stop writing political poems, because it's not really what my core interest is. But, you know, I think of my kids, I think about what's going on, and I have things I want to say.
I wrote the poem that annoyed some people during the during a summer. If you walk with a Nazi. The president of the United States said that there were some good people protesting in Charlottesville. Not for the first time, he was dead wrong. good people may have showed up to protest, but as soon as they stepped into the street to march with people waving Nazi flags, they were no longer good people. The Nazis killed 8 million homosexuals, gypsies, communists, and Christians, and, of course, 8 million Jews in their final solution. Over 400,000 Americans died in World War II fighting Japanese imperialism and the murderous Nazi philosophy. We saved the world. Those who march under the Nazi flag dishonored the greatest generation, and unfortunately, so does the President of the United States. Is that political enough, Boy Vincent?
That works for me. I mean, and I can understand how some people may be offended by it, though I don't agree with their being offended by it, and it may be negative to your poetry, but you got to follow your soul.
There's one other one that relates both to where I live and to what's going on. It's called The Top of My Hill. The top of my hill in Mayapack, New York, is home to a supposed state park. Suppose? Yes, suppose. There are no trees in the state park, no nature trail, no picnic tables, no swimming pools, athletic fields, or basketball courts. The only path into the park is chained to keep out the curious and the misinformed who think that there is a park. It's been this way for years. There's nothing there but overgrown weeds. Big signs on the highway treat it as real. Driving by, you might be misled, but not the locals to know the truth. This empty, barren travesty of a state park bears the name of a White House occupant. Do you see a parallel there?
I certainly do.
What do you think, Bob? What moves you to sit down to write?
All writing has always been therapy for me, frankly. I spent many, many years, as a matter of fact, you were the one who encouraged me sort of to get published. I wasn't getting published, and, you know, I spent years studying it. I've gone to all kinds of retreats, and as I mentioned, Sarah Lawrence, I took an MFA at University of New Hampshire, and still I wasn't publishing. And it was mostly because I love to write. And what was it, Joan Didion in that New York Times essay in the early 70s said, she writes to learn who she is, and I do as well. I find out who I am after I've written. And some of it isn't, you know, large revelations, but mostly it's just small things, you know. You mentioned Sharon Olds. I spent a week with her up at Omega. And at that time, she told a story at the time. She said that someone asked her where her music came from. And this was when I was writing poetry, as I considered myself a poet. And she said that it came from, she was almost embarrassed to admit it, but she said it came from the hymns that she heard in the Protestant church that her mother took her to. And I started reading her poetry differently after that. But right after she said that, I looked at my own work and said, Jesus, it's got a certain music, a cadence to it. And I tried to figure out, and I wrote a poem about it, about, you know, where my music comes from. And it comes from where you would guess. You know, it comes from an apartment house in Inwood. So, anyway. So, yeah, I can be moved by anything.
One of the interesting things that I've gotten from some of these poetry groups, though, is so counterintuitive to what we're talking about, is the ability to use prompts to go someplace and to find different things people have said you ought to write about this and been forcing yourself to. And I think that may, your craft, not necessarily your creativity. The other thing is there are many of these interesting groups on Facebook, and one of them is three-word line group where you're constrained. You will not have more than three words to a line, and you won't wrap around. You won't say and Bob Donahue look like, and then on to the next thing to what you were wearing. It's all completely different things, and I find that very interesting. John, do you write to prompts at all?
I don't do it too much. The poem I wrote for the 5-2 was almost like that because I saw on Facebook that they were looking for submissions. And one of the things about a lot of these poetry submissions is they want everything to be completely unpublished. And I usually post things to my personal blog and to my poetry Facebook page. And so I very rarely have poems that are completely and utterly unpublished. So I used that as a prompt, and I wrote that poem like that morning when I read the thing about the call for submissions. I don't do it too often because I usually have something knocking around in my head to write about. But they can be fun, and they can be, like you said, a good way of practicing your craft, even though not necessarily your own creativity. It does very much help you to learn to be able to put things together regardless sort of the inspiration.
Vincent, do you do anything like that?
Not too much, though. I must say I've recently started to play around with it. There's, I think the prompt that I did most recently was a 5-word story, and I found that to be really interesting. But mostly, I at this point in my life, I just focus on, as the previous person said, the words that are knocking around in my head.
Sometimes things will stick in the back of your mind. Dan Grout, who runs our poetry workshop, had talked about one-sentence poems, and I never saw any reason for that. And then all of a sudden, something popped into my head, and I wrote it, and it's out there someplace. It's Stormy fucked him once, and now she's doing it again. And people seem to like that. So I went on. What about you, Bob? Do you use any prompts or anything?
I never used prompts in poetry, but I do them frequently in fiction. And so, like, in my new life, I do them all the time. And I do it primarily because, I can feel like my craft isn't holding up. So if someone suggests a prompt, I find that it helps my craft.
Okay. Chick, is there anything that we haven't answered that you'd like to ask anyone in the group before we get off?
Yeah, does anybody make money from this?
Not that I know of, Chick.
I was going to say, you got to be kidding.
Yeah. Well, I this year, well, just last year, I published a book, and I didn't know it was going to be so expensive for me to write a book. But I'll still do it again if I could.
Well, you have a possibility. You have a movie option, and you have other things. For anyone that doesn't know about this book, as I mentioned, Chick's one of my oldest friends, and he was a high school dropout, went in the Marine Corps. When he got out of the Marine Corps, he became a merchant seaman, and that was during the Vietnam conflict. And during the protests against Vietnam, I lived in a very conservative Irish Catholic neighborhood. This lunatic bartender friend of ours said, you know, with all these protests going on, those guys over there, they must think we don't care about them. Someone's got to go over there and buy them a beer. Chickie, why don't you give me the merchant papers and I'll go? And Chickie realized that he couldn't do that, so he went over there. And he was actually able to find the people he was looking for, or at least four of them, by hitching around to combat zones, and he delivered beer. And then he got stuck there. He missed his ship. They got caught in the Tet Offensive, and he did whatever. And the book that came out of it 50 years later, or 48 years later, it was terrific. Since then, Chick has a master from Harvard, and he's been the Sandhog, and he's, and as I mentioned, a political operative. But he was able to. He's a storyteller. He only found out in his 70s he was dyslexic, which had to do with some of his inability as the young person to perform well in school, and he was able to tell his story, and the woman who works with him, Joanna Malloy, an ex-columnist for the Daily News, really, really captured his voice well. So he's been reading his books, and then he's been talking that union and that veterans things, and it may or may not make him a lot of money, or it may not. So, Chick, what's the complete title of the books so people they can run to Amazon and they can purchase it?
The Greatest Beer Run Ever.
By Chick Donahue and J.T.
Malloy.
Malloy. Oh, go down the list. Someone just came on. Let me see who this is. Aha, this was a while back. I was I came across this group, the Poetry Superhighway, and they have two featured poets per week. And I submitted a poem that many of you have heard already after, called Submission. And the other featured poet just came on. She's a North Carolina native who has a new book out. And why don't you tell the group something about you, LB, and then go read a poem to us.
Okay, great. Hey, John, how you doing?
Terrific.
I have a new book coming out. It's good to talk to you again. And I have a new book coming out called Words and Bones, and it's published by Finishing Line Press, and it's coming out this summer. So I'm pretty excited by that. So, and I'm going to read a poem from that one, if I may.
Go ahead.
Okay, this one's called Terra Firma Lane. Parking on grass, not past the tree, leaves and piles, old men telling stories, Christmas tree lightings, train cabooses and windmills, and when this old school was once a boarding school, we sit on uneven benches covered up with paint and read posters for basketball games years in the past. And folks talk and eat funnel cake or cotton candy while they wait for the competition to end. And the old man says it's good they found another use for the school, but the buildings are run down and in need of repair. And he's right, because the clock tower's four faces are all set to different times, 6 p.m., 4 p.m., 12 noon, and 1 o'clock, and there's no one left to fix it. And that particular poem is about an old boarding school that's here in the area where I live, and it is now a science center, I think. But I was sitting there waiting one day for an event to finish and looking at this clock with four different times on it, and I thought that was particularly interesting that it's all stuck in time, but all different times.
And Vincent, like you, who was in your case, and attorney and doing things like that, LB after college went off to Washington and she worked there in a commercial career, and then at some point she gave it up and then she came back to rural North Carolina, and she's been writing in addition to running a business, and she's been writing ever since. Did I describe it properly, Elby?
Yes, you did. You did. Mm-hmm. I did live in Washington for a long time and decided I'd go back to school. And then I went back to Washington and got tired of that. Anyway, I am back in rural North Carolina. Yes, it's pretty rural where we live. We don't even have a bookstore.
Do you have another one to read to us?
Oh, sure. This one is not from the book. This is just a poem that I like that I wrote the other day. Again, about some of the things. This is, I'm a reader. I like to write. So I'm one of the few people that probably, I read menus. I read the advertisements everywhere. I read billboards. So this came from a billboard that I saw outside a store near where I live, actually. It's called "We Have Crickets, We Have Handmade Cedar Furniture." Bogarting chips, bogarting people, bogarting fish with handmade tied fly fishing lures, dangling homemade jewelry, pottery, paintings, photographs of tough characters, Casablanca, the African Queen, the Maltese Falcon, the treasure of the Sierra Madre, cool, hardened exteriors, hogging cigarettes, joints, taking more fish than you need to fill your fridge, taking more trees than you need to fill your house, dangling from your mouth until almost entirely consumed.
Dude, all those great Humphrey Bogart movies in there. Before you came on, we were talking about the craft of writing and the fact that some people, to hone their craft, write from prompts, whether in magazines or in workshops. Do you do anything like that, or does the thing just come out of you that you see in the area, or do you think about?
Sometimes I do, but usually what I do is I tend to work from an idea, or almost always a title. I've written a local poetry book that I've done a lot of readings and have taught a lot of school classes poetry lately from. And in that case, I'm using pictures of real places that I'm writing from. I see those poetry prompts, fiction prompts in writing magazines that I look at and different things. And it's kind of hard for me to use that sometimes, or even if you have to write sometimes I look at publications and they have a certain theme they want you to write to, and that's not always something I can do because I just write a lot of different things. So, but sometimes they can give you some good ideas as to what you can do, especially if you can't think of how to start a poem.
So we've had people from up and down the East Coast calling from Florida, from North Carolina, from Connecticut, from parts of New York, from New Hampshire. Before I go off, let's go through. Is there anything that you'd like to add, Vincent?
Not really. This is the first time I've been on your radio show, and I just find it to be really fascinating, and I hope to be able to do it again.
Normally, I only have one guest at the time, and Terry Dugan was on earlier, then Ralph and John and Bob and Chick and LB have all been on. So yeah, you're on the list. John, do you have anything to add?
Not too much. I wanted to thank you for having me on, and I thought this having multiple people on worked really great. It was very interesting and fun.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, but there was a problem. There was supposed to be many more people on. For instance, Ann Cifola, who's a very good poet, who was the one who put me together with Terry Dugan, has been trying to get on, and apparently there's too many people. So I didn't get her on. Bob Zaslav didn't get in. So there's a whole. We were limited by the number of people. When Ralph went off, I thought that that maybe we'd get other people on. LB, had you been trying to get on, or was that your first shot?
That was my first shot. I had actually been listening since you started, but I just called just when you got me on. I called right before that. So.
Okay. Okay, Lenny, do you have anything to add?
No, I enjoyed it tonight. I'm not much of the political side, but I enjoyed everything I heard.
Okay, Bob.
I appreciated the variety of voices, and I liked the exchange. So it was very positive for me. Thanks, John.
Okay, and as we usually do, we'll wrap up again with Chick. Do you have anything to add, Chick?
No, John, I enjoyed the show tonight. I really did. And I did. I liked the variety of different poets, and the logic and the reasoning of why. It was very interesting. Thanks for inviting.
And the Donahue boys are off to Ireland, so we wish them all a good trip and a safe home. And
Thank you. And
we talked about, you mentioned Sharon Olds and her the hymns that she heard being responsive for her music in her to Protestant church. So tonight we'll go out with one of my favorite hymns. We'll go out with Amazing Grace.
Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saves.